Okay, director's report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, on behalf of the Division of Marine Fisheries, I want to extend my congratulations to Mr. Romano for his reappointment. I want to welcome Robert and Martin to the commission, and if there's anything the division staff or I can do to assist you, please let us know. I would also like to take this opportunity to thank outgoing commissioners Chuck Loffridge and Brad Corey for their dedicated service to the state. This is a difficult job, as you all know, and I wish them well in their future endeavors. As you know, our longtime commission liaison, Nancy Fish, retired August 1st, despite my protests, and we're in the process of finding a replacement. For this meeting, I've asked Catherine to sit up here and try to keep me straight. She's been doing an outstanding job, as always, so I appreciate Catherine's efforts. I also want to thank Dana Gillikin, who has really been running the office by herself down there, and she's been doing an outstanding job. So it's often the people sort of behind the door that are doing all the work. I would like to announce that beginning with the November meeting, we are planning on transitioning from this giant book to an iPad. This is being done to provide easier access to materials by the commission and to reduce costs, because this is getting prohibitively expensive. To facilitate preparation by the division staff, it'll be easier for us to put this together if we can just upload it there, and to save a few trees. So Dana has ordered the units. I think they're being ordered now with the keyboard in a hard case, so you guys won't tear them up too bad. And we provide providing some basic training for you as well, and we're beta testing them as we speak. So Southern Flounder, at this meeting, of course, you're scheduled to act on the Southern Flounder Draft Amendment 2. As you all know, we have all received a lot of public comment, all of which has been sent to you and added to your notebooks. Much of the comment I have heard centers around the percent reductions and the seasons, particularly in the central area. So while the division and department stand by our recommendations for seasons that provide 62 and 72% reduction of harvest, which is above the threshold of 52% necessary to end overfishing in 2 years and rebuild the fishery in 10. It's closer to the target and is the target in the second year. However, Draft Amendment 2 contains numerous season options, and the division included a September 15th commercial opening for all areas as an attempt to provide some period of peak season for all gears. But I would like to state, however, that any of the season options in Draft Amendment 2 that meet that 62 and 72% reduction meet our recommendation. And after talking with council, I do not believe a supermajority would be needed to change those seasons should the commission wish to do that. Also, when this commission moves to adopt Amendment 2, the proclamation authority that is my mic still on? Stand by.
Test.
Okay, so when this commission moves to adopt Amendment 2, under the settlement agreement, the proclamation authority that you grant the director also comes back. So that will provide us with a little bit of flexibility to make some adjustments in there and work with the industry, both rec and commercial. And, of course, most importantly to us, as soon as you adopt that, we will immediately start working on Amendment 3, which is where We want to look at the more involved quotas, slots, species, those types of things, trip limits that we think can make this a little more, livable. So, the division held its first Southern Flounder four-state work group meeting in July. We'll have another meeting next week. The work group wanted to actually see what came out of this commission meeting. The action item for that meeting was for those work group members from the other states to provide an overview of their state intent and to reduce Southern Flounder harvest. So that will be next week. As I've mentioned, the new gear requirements for shrimp trawls went into effect July 1 for areas of Pamlico Sound, portions of Pamlico and Neuse River. Our Marine Patrol has been conducting compliance checks with our vessel, the Roanoke, with the U.S. Coast Guard, and report good compliance from the industry. I think some of the out-of-state boats had got some bogus information, and their gears, I think in some instances, weren't properly configured, so we're addressing that. These new requirements, of course, were approved by the Commission at the May 2018 business meeting as part of Amendment 1. And so we continue to work on gear testing. We received funding. Kevin Brown's group received funding from two sources, one through the Commercial Fishing Resource Fund and one through the Atlantic Coast Fisheries Cooperative Management Act, what we like to call it FCMA. To continue shrimp trawl bycatch and gear testing, so that will be sampling areas which will specifically occur in the ocean waters this fall from Wrightsville Beach to the South Carolina line. I want to report on the status of the peer review manuscript for the shrimp bycatch reduction industry work group. It's been a long process, which publishing often is, but I'm pleased to announce that the cooperative work led by Kevin Brown that led to the bycatch reduction effort with the industry work groups entitled Simple Gear Modifications Achieve Greater Than 40% Bycatch Reduction in Estuarine Shrimp Trawl Fishery was provisionally accepted this month by the Fishery Bulletin and is currently undergoing edits. So we're very proud of that and the work that Kevin and all his group has done, and appreciate the other agencies and especially the industry, which this wouldn't have been possible without their support, because for the most part they gave up their time and effort for free to let us do this kind of stuff. Funding was granted for 1 year through the Commercial Fishing Resource Fund to develop a mail-in survey to help characterize bycatch reduction devices and the turtle excluder devices used by commercial shrimpers. The objectives of this study are to gather info on birds and teds used in the industry, better understand different gear types and arrangements used in the shrimp fishery, and how that shifts among target species to assist to understand better socioeconomic profile of shrimp trawl fishermen, including annual cash flow and economic constraints, to understand the potential economic impacts of gear modifications on the shrimp trawl fishery and how that may shape future catch participation. The survey, I think, is to occur later this year in 2019. Update on alewife and blueback herring status. June 19th, 2019, NOAA Fisheries released their finding of a comprehensive status review for these two species based on best scientific and commercial data available. NOAA Fisheries found that alewife and blueback herring are not in danger of extinction throughout all or in a significant portion of their range, including distinct population segments, nor are they likely to become so within the foreseeable future. Therefore, they do not meet the definition of threatened and endangered species and do not warrant listing as threatened or endangered at this time. Sort of back to the division, the habitat enhancement section has completed the Swan Isle and Oyster Sanctuary at the mouth of Neuse River. This is a 40-acre reef It's an immense project. It was about $3 million project done in close partnership with the North Carolina Coastal Federation and their contractor, Stevens Towing. And it was really an excellent project to leverage state funding and really double the amount of enhancement activity that could have been done. The project involved deployment of 25,000 tons of granite and about 55,000 tons of limestone marl over a three-year period. The material was deployed in several dozen ridges of about 200 feet long by 20 feet wide to 4 to 6 feet tall. It's built this way to increase the likelihood of larval oyster settlement and survival of oysters, especially during low oxygen events. And it's also become a very popular artificial reef for recreational anglers in the area, with some pretty massive speckled trout being caught off of it. The division has constructed over 357 acres now of oyster sanctuaries in Pamlico Sound as part of what is known as the Gene Preston Oyster Sanctuary Network. And so we congratulate those folks on all that hard work. Artificial reef construction is also taking place in Dare County, thanks to the North Carolina Department of Transportation and their replacement of the Bonner Bridge. This has been a long time in the planning, over 10 years now, between the division and DOT, and their contractors are already putting that material out, but it will be approximately 80,000 tons of material from the bridge are being placed on four artificial reef sites off of Oregon Inlet. And if you go over the new bridge, which is great, you'll see a couple barges down there and all that material stacked up on there. So this will be the first major expansion of those reefs in many years, so we're very excited about that. The August edition of the division newsletter Insight was recently released. This release explains how funds generated from the sale of coastal recreational fishing licenses are used and highlights some of the projects that have been funded. And it can be accessed on the division's website under news, and it is online only. We don't have paper copies of that. Speaking of the CRUFL, I want to provide a brief update on the status on the request for proposals. An RFP was issued this year with focused projects to address division data needs, as well as outreach opportunities. The division received 17 proposals. Our internal review team met in July to review them and develop recommendations. And because we've had a commission change and the last chair was of the commission subcommittee was Commissioner Loughridge, at your convenience, Chairman Bizzle, we'll need you to appoint a new chair for the CRUFL Advisory Committee, and then we will work with them to see when they would like to meet and review the proposals. And at that point, the grants office will bring both of the committee's recommendations, internal and MFC, to my office for funding decisions. And so just to remind you, the CRUFL Advisory Committee on the MFC is the three recreational seats and, I believe, Pete. So I would also like to welcome our new CRUFL project coordinator, Jamie Botanovich. And she'll be proud of me because I got her name right, because I wrote it down that way. The division continues to partner with several groups to provide materials and education to reduce discard mortality in the recreational sector. And I believe Chris and his staff have already handed out some of the stuff that we've been distributing through FishSmart. We received 50 Sequalizer descenders, 125 Shelton descenders, and 1,000 short leader red drum rigs from FishSmart. Each type of device was accompanied with a pamphlet on best practices and device-specific information. For your new commissioners, North Carolina is really the only southeastern state that has a specific rule in inside waters for red drum with circle hooks. So we require a non-offset 4-aught circle hook in a short 6-inch or less leader. So FishSmart made sure that the short leader rigs they provided us were compliant with this, and we expect to have these distributed by the end of the year. We've also been, Chris and his group have also been working with National Marine Fisheries Service Recreational Fishery Policy Program. They've made available to the states a variety of conservation items, including approximately 7,000 grouper, bass, sea bass, drum, and inshore fish circle hooks. And we are using these as conservation giveaways to our anglers. And our coastal angling program, or CAP, is also considering purchasing up to 1,000 dehookers to distribute to recreational anglers. And then finally, we have a variety of educational information at the back of the room. Drones, the division is currently increasing our ability to map and do aerial surveys with the use of drones. Currently, DMF has one drone, but it's really nifty, and are licensing several staff to be able to operate drones according to the federal and state law under our DEQ and state drone policy. I would like to really thank Dr. Mike Griffin with the IT and Morehead City office, because he has not only spearheaded this, but he's also a pilot, and he has been training people on how to do this. And as a proof of concept project with DIT, UNC Wilmington, and DMF, a project entitled Mapping North Carolina's Estuarine Benthic Habitat with Unmanned Aerial System, that had been done in the past, was selected as an award finalist in the Business Process Innovations category for the National Association of State Chief Information Officers, or NESCO. So we congratulate that group as well. On the habitat side, DMF is working with the Albemarle Pamlico National Estuarine Program to remap high salinity seagrass sites, or SAV, submerged aquatic vegetation, from Roanoke Sound up in Dare County all the way to Mason's Inlet in New Hanover County. This is a huge effort that included the assistance of many partners. APNEP contracted with North Carolina Department of Transportation to conduct the flights and provide the aerial imagery. DMF staff from multiple sections and several other agencies, including APNEP, Division of Water Resources, Marine Corps, Camp Lejeune, U.S. Coast Guard Cape Hatteras, Hammocks Beach State Park, NOAA, and DCM's National Estuarine Reserve, conducted over 600 field verifications of bottom habitat, referred to as ground truthing. The next step is DMF will be hiring a temporary biologist to do photo interpretation of that ground truth data, and that's basically a process involving GIS software to draw polygons around areas that appear as SAV. This is the third time we've done this mapping. We'd love to be able to do it more often. We've done it previously in 2007 and 2013. But repeating mapping allows assessment of change in distribution. We get to see where it's growing, where it's receding, because SAV is one of the critical habitats for many, many important fishery species we have, including spotted sea trout, drum, blue crab, and shrimp, as well as many offshore species such as gag grouper. And it provides a lot of ecosystem services. So it's really a key habitat for us to monitor as an indicator of overall estuary health. I'd like to report, although we're not taking a lead on this, this is certainly having impacts on stakeholders in this area, and that is the Chowan River area. Charlton and the Elizabeth City staff have been assisting with sampling waters in the Chowan River in the upper Albemarle Sound area. This area has been experiencing, if you've been watching the news, higher than normal cyanobacteria, or what used to be known as blue-green algae blooms. DEQ's Division of Water Resources is taking the lead on this, and we are assisting them as well as NC State University in taking water samples, tissue samples, and working with them to try to get a handle on this. This past Friday, the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services actually issued a press release saying that the test results indicate the bloom in the Chowan River near Indian Creek is producing microcystin levels greater than 620 micrograms per liter. At these levels, officials with the DPH would consider this bloom an extremely high risk for acute health effects during recreational exposure based on guidance values published by the World Health Organization. So when we talk about water quality, certainly this is something that we're very concerned about. This, and this is a sort of a reoccurring trend now every year in this area. Division staff news. We have a new division economist, David Dietz. David, do you want to stand up? This is David Dietz. David joins us from Duke University's Nicholas School of the Environment, where he earned a master's degree in environmental management, focusing on fisheries, economics, and related issues. He grew up in Maine, attended college in that state, and then worked in market research and consulting in New York before going back to school. So we're very excited to have him join the License and Statistics section. He works out of the Green Square office here in Raleigh and then visits us when Stephanie tells him to come and visit us. So he's already working on several surveys that will be sent out later this year. So thank you, David. Laura Lee, as you all know, has been asked by Fisheries and Oceans Canada National Headquarters to serve as an external scientific peer reviewer on the stockwide assessment framework to the American eel. And so she will be doing that. Eel is actually a very important species, and it's a panmictic species, so it kind of occurs everywhere at the same time. It's an extremely interesting life cycle on that. Tom Tears, who I introduced at the last meeting, our new stock assessment person, will be presenting at the International Council of Exploration of the Sea annual science conference in Gothenburg, Sweden, on the effects of spatial structure demographics on stock assessment of the Atlantic sheep's head. So this talk specifically addresses how assessment models are sensitive to latitudinal gradients of growth parameters and estimates, and spawning stock biomass recruitment and exploitation rate can be biased as a result of overlooking these gradients. He specializes in stock assessment, not sentence structure. So, because that was a long sentence. Steve Poland, who was just up here a minute ago, and of course serves as our commissioner to the South Atlantic Fishery Management Council. He is now a co-author on a manuscript that's been accepted to be published in the North American Journal of Fisheries Management. This paper is entitled Estimating Discard Mortality for Dolphin in a Recreational Hook and Line Fishery. It's authored by Paul Rudershausen, Steve Poland, Wes Merton, and Jeff Buckle. And they used a novel tagging and dockside sampling approach to generate an estimate of discard mortality from dolphin fish in the hook and line fishery in the South Atlantic. So they're going to present this at the South Atlantic Fishery Management Council, actually, to aid in their discussions on dolphin management within that region. Also, would like to recognize several interns that we have. We're very fortunate to host four summer interns. They're funded under the North Carolina Internship Program through the North Carolina Department of Administration. This is something the governor likes to see agencies get young people and try to get their feet wet in the real world. Several current staff that are now DMF employees were once interns. So I'll run through them real quick and kind of their contributions for us. Haley Gamble, who was a rising senior from NC State. She analyzed historical fishery data and current NC trip ticket data to document trends in landings, ex-vessel value, and effort in the commercial striped bass fishery. And it was actually very interesting, even though Alan would never let her turn the light on in his office. So the analysis included a breakdown of the fishery temporally, by area, by region, and by gear. And her final analysis was published in a report entitled The North Carolina Striped Bass Commercial Fishery. So we have that available if anybody would like that. Elizabeth Branch is a senior at Appalachian State. She worked on a project entitled Assessment and Management of Coastal Fishery Resources on the Outer Banks in the Manio Field Office. She assisted with collection of biological data through the aging lab, carcass collection, tagging, trawling, gill netting, and commercial fish house sampling, and she also assisted with data coding and data management. Callie Simpson is a rising junior at NC State. She spent the summer working with the Shellfish Sanitation and Recreational Water Quality Section, helping to develop a new program for screening for the presence of toxic-producing algae species within our shellfish growing waters. So these toxin-producing species are what we know as harmful algal blooms, and they can impact, if anybody remembers 1987 when we had a big red tide, they can be serious issues not only for public health but also for commercial and recreational fisheries. So she collected samples from several locations throughout the state and uses them to test, troubleshoot, and begin implementation of that new protocol. So we appreciate that. And finally, Isabel Johnson, she's a sophomore at UNC Wilmington. She was responsible for researching scientific documents, creating an inventory and database, and cataloging those documents for the division's internal library. She also assisted with various projects and programs, including fish tagging, collecting biological data in the aging lab, commercial fish house sampling, gill netting, carcass collection, marine mammal stranding. She was busy. And teamed up with APNEP to help identify seagrasses. I think she worked with my wife, actually, one week. So we thank all of these interns for their significant contributions, and we wish them all well in their biology careers. An update on Hurricane Florence, commercial fishing assistance. As you remember, the North Carolina General Assembly and the governor approved a total of about $11.5 million for direct assistance to commercial fishing, commercial fishers based on reductions in landings. That project has been complete, and I'd like to congratulate Stephanie and her staff, who have really done a tremendous amount of work to get this done in the amount of time it was done. And so a total of $11,472,603 was issued to 1,176 licensed commercial fishermen. So that was a good project. We have another federal fishery disaster project that is pending. Governor Cooper rapidly moved after Hurricane Florence to request from the U.S. Department of Commerce requesting federal fishery disaster assistance. This is a program available under the Magnuson-Stevens Act. The Department of Commerce has granted this request. Congress has authorized funding for national disasters, and we're currently waiting to hear from National Marine Fisheries Service on what level of assistance will be available to North Carolina. After we're contacted, our next steps are to develop a request for proposal to NIMS to look at areas such as tackle stores for higher industries, commercial infrastructure, and even damaged habitat. And so I hope to have an update for you at our November meeting.
Can I ask a quick question about that?
Yep.
So for there's no opportunity at the state level to help tackle shops or charter guides. We didn't do that, right? That's gone. That opportunity is passed. It would be federal assistance.
I don't know, because it stems from the legislature. So the legislature is still in session as of this morning. I think we still didn't have a budget. So I don't know.
Right.
Yeah.
And when we did where did the request for to help the commercial fishing industry start? Did we ask for that, or did that just start at the legislature? That started at the legislature, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure where it started. I think it was industry that went to legislators, I believe, but I don't know. So
okay. I'd love for any opportunity we can get, for particularly for charter guides and fishing guides who absolutely lost business during that time,
right,
to be assisted as well.
Right.
And so whatever we can do to champion that would be great.
So I'd like to turn it over now to Kathy Rawls to explain the work she and her staff have been doing to improve and streamline the fishery management process. And I think I just want her to give a brief report on that, because I think it's going to also help get us to answers in these FMPs a lot quicker. Oh, hang on.
So what are you including in the SAB?
I would have, I don't...
Submerged aquatic plants or bass-grown plants, seagrasses?
Yeah, seagrasses. It's in the high salinity area, so we're not getting back up into like the Albemarle because it's a different methodology, is my understanding. So.
Are you differentiating between the three species with the relative change?
Yeah, so the ground truthing involves going out, keying out by species, enumerating, and basically measuring spatial extent. That's kind of what they're looking for. Right.
Thank you, Director Murphy. Commissioners, welcome to the new commissioners. I must say you guys jump from the fat to the fire pretty well. And if you feel like you're not practiced up, tomorrow you'll get some more practice. So welcome aboard, and I look forward to working with all of you. For those of you who do not know me, my name is Kathy Rawls. I am the Fisheries Management Section Chief for the Division of Marine Fisheries. The Fisheries Management Section is responsible for drafting fishery management plans. It is a division-wide effort, but the Fisheries Management Section does lead that effort. The Division of Marine Fisheries has been developing fishery management plans for a pretty long time, pretty much since 1998 was our first plan, I think. We worked since the Fisheries Reform Act came into effect in 97, mandated that the department prepare fishery management plans for all commercially and recreationally important species. So we've been in this business a long time, and I think we have learned a lot along the way. We are looking to address comments from stakeholders, from staff, from commissioners, past and present, that have identified that the process is too long, it's cumbersome, it's hard to follow, there's a lack of timely response to management issues and a host of other things that we've heard along the way. We have been working pretty much in baby steps to streamline the FMP development process, and I'm going to briefly update you on some of the key changes that we are looking at making in that process as we move forward in our FMP schedules. We intend to implement this new process right away in the upcoming FMPs that we will be working on. So, in a nutshell, what we have our sights set on is a more effective, efficient FMP development process, and I'm sure that everybody, even those that are least familiar with it, can agree that that's something we all want. We want to garner focused and informed stakeholder input and really build stakeholder confidence. We have seen that degrade over the years, and I for one, am looking forward to trying to work with stakeholders to build that back up, and I know all the staff is as well. The changes that I'm going to be going over today are really focused on FMP development process, including how we work with the advisory committee and what the FMP documents look like. The changes don't really impact the steps that we take to garner ideas from the commission or to bring the drafts to the commission and out to the public. So it doesn't affect those parts of it. Again, the main goal is making the process better, making it more effective, making it more efficient, and not just shorter. So the three things that we're going to go over are the timing of the FMP, the development of the FMP itself, how we work with the advisory committees, and then what the documents are going to look like at the end of that. So the first thing that we're going to do, and I will tell you that for the new commissioners, I will say that I may be using the term plan development team. You've already heard it here today several times, and that is basically just our internal group of biologists that are make up from different sections, and it is our internal subject matter experts that are assigned to each species to develop each fishery management plan. So if you hear me use the term plan development team or PDT, that's what I'll be referring to. So let's just use spotted sea trout because it is coming up pretty soon in our schedule, and Catherine's going to go over the schedule with you, I think, tomorrow, and you'll hear about that. But let's just take spotted sea trout as an example. So what we're going to do is utilize a series of kickoff scoping-type public meetings to explain the modified process. That will be part of it early on until people get the hang of this. Inform the public that an FMP is underway, and also review the stock condition with the public and seek input on potential issues. And also at these meetings, we're going to want to look for potential advisors at these meetings and just have discussions with folks and see who is interested in participating in this process. Years ago, we used to develop a it was called a public information brochure, and it was just a little three-folded paper that we passed out before we developed each fishery management plan. And that's kind of what that public information brochure was designed to do. So we're going to take, we don't do that anymore, but we're going to implement these meetings in place of that kind of. This is a key change. So the other thing, main thing that we're going to do here is the plan development team is going to develop the first draft of the fishery management plan in its entirety before it is passed out to the advisory committee to look at. That is a huge change for everybody, and that draft will incorporate the input we get from the stakeholders at these scoping meetings and also the input that we get from the commission on potential issues that will be included. This this is similar to the way that other councils and commissions develop FMPs. Our current process is more of we do this in pieces. The plan development team will work on a section or two, and then they will go and present it to the advisory to the advisory committee, back to the plan development team for some more sections, back to the advisory committee, and it's over a long period of time. This is going to be a shorter, more focused period of time and not such a chopped-up process. We hope it is more efficient to do this in one fell swoop. I believe that it's going to keep the plan development team and the advisory committees focused on what they should be concentrating on and not so much time in between their meetings and whatnot. Once the comprehensive draft one basically is ready, then we will activate the advisory committee. So for the advisory committee, this is how we meet with the advisory committee. To me, is another key component of developing these FMPs. How do we meet with these advisory committees that have been appointed by the chair? These, the role of the FMP advisory committees is completely different than the standing ACs. The role of the FMP advisory committees is laid out in statute, and it is to assist the division with the development of these fishery management plans. And it seems like oftentimes in our current process, it seems that the Division of Marine Fisheries and the advisory committees are on completely separate tracks, that we're not even focusing on the same things. And sometimes that is hard. It's confusing for the public. It's confusing for the advisory committee. And we believe in the public input process, and we also value the input of the public and the stakeholders, but we do believe that there is room for improvement in how we gather that input. So I think we, especially for a government agency, we are thinking outside the box here, and we are going to try to, and I believe this will be some significant improvements for this overall process. So the AC members will be basically meet with the PDT as a work group in a workshop format. So this will be currently the plan development team members don't normally attend the AC meetings every once in a while, but mostly the advisory committee members are familiar with the co-leads. And this way, it'll be the entire PDT. There'll be subject matter experts there on key biological data programs that go into stock assessments. We'll all be sitting at the table together. They will be participating right alongside the FMP co-leads and the advisory committees and basically forming an FMP work group, if you will. The meetings will be on a more aggressive schedule in a shorter time span. Normally, we meet, we start at 6 o'clock. We may have 1 hour of public comment, and then the rest of it is AC business, but sometimes the public comment is longer. The issues are very complicated in a couple of hours. It's just not enough time to go over some of these things. So we may meet longer, and we may meet more frequently. We may have two-day workshops. We may meet once a week for a shorter period of time. We may meet every other week. It just really depends, and we'll work with that as we work through this process. The deliverables for the work group, which is the AC and the PDT, again, will be a list of items for consideration for inclusion in the fishery management plan, and then ultimately draft number 2 that will go to the commission. There will be no chairs or co-chairs, no motions or votes. The workshop, again, is a true workshop, and it's open to the public. We these will be true workshops. We do support, again, public to come and listen and prepare themselves for informed public comment when these plans do go out for public comment. And there's an official time period built into the process for that. This is a big change for staff, really, and advisory committees and stakeholders. We are tailoring this process in hopes that we can get focused, constructive participation from AC members who are objective and really willing to sit down and stay informed, stay engaged, and roll their sleeves up with us and dive into this FMP development process together. So the final thing are the documents. What are the deliverables going to look like? I think our first fishery management plan was Blue Crabs, and it was probably like 500, 600, 700 pages. We know that times have changed since 1998, and it's the age of electronic communication. People text, they Snapchat to communicate, and we consume information in very small pieces, and our attention spans are not very long anymore. We are keeping these things in mind as we are working towards creating these different type of FMP documents. So we're basically going to be looking at not one FMP document, but two. So I know y'all are really happy about that. But the first document is going to be more of your technical document, somewhat similar to what you've looked at, hopefully not as long, but it will be focused similar to the annual FMP review documents that Catherine is going to be going over with you later, and they're in your book with the purple cover. We're trying to make the FMP itself more concise and focused on the management of the species. After all, this is an fishery management plan. In our previous documents, they're huge. There's all sorts of information on just about anything you can want to know, say on spotted sea trout or whatever the species is. But these are going to be more streamlined and more focused on the management of the species. We want these to be more informative and creative and something that the public actually wants to pick up and actually will find useful when they do pick it up and flip through it. The second thing that you're not used to that we're going to try and do after each FMP is adopted and finalized, we want to produce a brochure-like document that will basically be the cliff notes for what happened in the FMP. It'll be like one-stop shopping for speckled trout. So this document was created by the License and Statistics section, and it highlights their coastal angling program, and we envision that these FMP cliff notes are going to look something like this, and it'll clearly lay out what happened in the fishery management plan and what management strategies, say, we adopted for spotted sea trout. So, again, we plan on using these new approaches in our upcoming FMPs, and we have quite a few that we're getting ready to work on. We're already working on some stock assessments for spotted sea trout and striped bass, and obviously going to be working on shrimp. We plan to use these techniques. As with most processes, the devil is in the details, and we're still working on the details. So we are going to be tweaking these, and we are willing to work with these new processes. And as we put them in place, we may have to change some things. Some might work well, and some might not work very well. And we will just have to, respond accordingly to that. We are prepared to make changes as we need to make this process easier and better for everybody involved. So I'll be glad to answer questions about this. Again, we are still hammering out some of the details, and I will be glad to answer any questions from stakeholders, the commissioners, or at any time here or even after the meeting. At any time, feel free to call me if anybody has any questions or, has some ideas. We're always open to those as well. So that's all I have, Mr.
Right
Chairman.
Now. Okay, great. Kat, thank you.
Yes, sir.
The more streamlined, the better.
Yes, sir. I understand that.
Thank you, Kat. And I think Kat has, she really has a true vision of this. And the staff have been working on this for quite a long time. And I'm really excited at seeing it put into place. And I think it's going to be a great product and get you something that's, much quicker and more comprehensive. So, I'd like to take just a few moments to talk about conflicts in public trust waters. So in my tenure as director, but also as a division employee for coming on 32 years now, the two conflicts I hear most often from the public are for shellfish mariculture siting and fishing gear, narrow creeks, canals, or docks. And so I'd like to talk about some of the options available, really, that you have to address these, and maybe some that aren't so well understood. So for shellfish leasing conflicts, I'm really seeing an increasing level of siting conflict with shellfish mariculture. This is due in part to the use of water column gear and the increase in applications for leases by the public. 20 years ago, we might have been lucky to get 10 or 12 applications for shellfish leases in a year. Now we get, 80 to 100. And they're almost all water column leases. Significant oyster harvest from leases, however, is now often equal or exceeds our wild harvest. So it is becoming significant. As Commissioner Bizzle discussed in Senate Bill 648 and Session Law 2019-37, that was signed into law by the governor, this law promotes aquaculture, but it also establishes two new two-year moratorium areas. So it's a little bit of a Jekyll and Hyde in that it's trying to promote aquaculture while at the same time restricting aquaculture in some areas. And that's to address this conflict. But I think that's, in my mind, that's sort of a big stick approach to this. And I think we can do better. So it also provides this commission the opportunity to also address conflicts. And one is that through the study that we're going to be doing with you to address user conflicts. And Jacob and his staff are working on that. And we'll be bringing you a draft. But we would welcome any input that you have either now or between now and then, and feel free to call Jacob or myself and discuss ideas that you might have. The other option is through the establishment of the Shellfish Leash Review Committee that Chairman Bizzle discussed. That's to serve it as an administrative remedy to address conflicts, but by the time you get to there, you've already got a conflict that's getting ready to go legal. So the way this works now is if you have any aggrieved person on a lease, whether it be the applicant or anybody else who doesn't like the decision to grant the lease, can appeal directly to the Office of Administrative Hearings. And so we often end up faced with court going before a judge to do this. This will provide administrative remedy, at least in part, so that we can hopefully reduce that. However, this new law also provides the authority for the division to develop what are known as shellfish aquaculture enterprise areas. So these are areas that would be cited by the division, not applicants, after a long process of making sure they're in the right place, and then we would parcel those out and lease them directly to growers. So for the growers, once we had them sited, it would be a very expedient way of getting into the business. From our standpoint, it might be a better way to address sort of hot areas where people apply, and as soon as they apply, we kind of know we're going to have a problem. But your existing statute in 113-201 also empowers this commission to limit the number of acres in any area that may be granted as shellfish leases. And you can do this by rulemaking. So I want to remind you that you do have that authority that's given to you by the North Carolina General Assembly. Gear conflicts may lead to significant conflicts between user groups. And the ones that we typically see, or at least I've seen, are over the use of nets in canals, narrow creeks, or near docks. People often want me to just issue a proclamation to eliminate the conflict, but it's a bit more complex than that. And while your rule in 03-H-0103 provides general proclamation criteria for variable conditions not set forth in rule, including the consideration of user conflicts, another rule, 03-I-0122, is specific to how the director may, by proclamation, address requests over user conflicts. So this rule requires, based on the director's finding following a valid request, that a public hearing be held, and if the conflict cannot be resolved, a proclamation be submitted to this commission for approval that addresses that conflict. So that's a proclamation I have to bring to you for your approval before we can implement it. This rule went into effect in 2015. I believe it's only been used once up in the northern part of the state, and in that case, the conflict could not be resolved and ultimately resulted in the proclamation, which was approved. This rule, however, is silent on how to rescind a proclamation. And so I think it's imperative so that we don't permanently close an area forever with no way to take the proclamation off, that we try to look at the long-term view on these types of things, maybe temporal conditions or something along that line. A more comprehensive approach to this to address user conflict may be through rules. As was pointed out in the Wildlife Federation, this commission does have the authority to establish rules to regulate the placement of nets or other sports or commercial fishing apparatus in coastal waters, to address concerns about navigation or recreational safety as well as from a conservation standpoint. So this option is also available to you, but because of potential user impacts and stakeholder input necessary for these types of rules, the division would recommend using the FMP process to address this. So, if you did have something where you wanted to look at restrictions of one gear or another, we would ask that you use that FMP process. However, you do have the authority to develop them as a single issue. So that's just kind of a couple things I wanted to talk about. In the use conflict is something that is always, I'm getting a call usually about once a month on this type of thing, and so I wanted to address that. So if there's no questions, I'm going to turn the floor over to Chris Batsavage for an update on the ASMFC summer meeting.
Pete.
I think it's a good idea. Let's take a 10-minute break, not a 20-minute, 10-minute. All right, let's go ahead and tee this thing up. Mike will be here in a minute. Go ahead, Chris, whenever you're ready. We're ready for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And welcome to new commissioners. I'm Chris Batsavage. I'm Director Murphy's ongoing proxy on the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission. Is that better? Right, for folks out in the web world, can you hear me? I'll be giving an update on the ASMFC summer meeting that happened a couple weeks ago up in Arlington, Virginia. In your supplemental materials, you'll see a memo hitting on the highlights as well as a meeting summary from ASMFC. As I normally do, I'll just be hitting on the highlights from that meeting, and just kind of go in the order of the memo. So I'll start off with COBIA. Amendment 1 to the ASMFC COBIA FMP was approved. It establishes management measures for COBIA from New York to Florida that are solely managed by ASMFC. The plan through the South Atlantic Council was discontinued a few months ago, so ASMFC has sole responsibility now for managing the species in that area. So this means ASMFC now will be setting harvest quotas and sector allocations, defining stock status criteria, and monitoring and closing, if necessary, the commercial fishery. The commercial size limit of 33 inches fork length and the vessel limit of up to 6 fish per vessel remain unchanged, but states can implement more restrictive measures to prevent the commercial quota from being reached too early in the year, and to implement consistent regulations for the commercial and recreational fisheries. And just as a recent history, the commercial fishery has closed early the last couple of years, and it'll probably happen again this year too. The recreational harvest limit will now be monitored using numbers of fish instead of pounds of fish due to the high uncertainty and annual variability in average fish weights of cobia. And finally, ASMFC will recommend to NOAA Fisheries that fishing in federal waters be regulated to the state of landing. So that would mean regulations resulting from this recommendation would only these regulations resulting from the recommendation would only apply in federal waters, but fishermen would still be required to file a state possession or landing limits in state waters. All right, next is striped bass. The Striped Bass Management Board approved draft addendum 6 to the Striped Bass FMP for public comment. And just as a little background, direct ASMFC management of striped bass in North Carolina only applies to fish caught in the Atlantic Ocean. Management from this action will not apply to the state's estuarine striped bass populations. The draft addendum provides a range of management alternatives designed to end overfishing and reduce fishing mortality to the target level in 2020. It proposes management options for both the commercial and recreational sectors in the ocean and in Chesapeake Bay to reduce total fishery removals by 18% relative to the 2017 levels. These options include reduced commercial quotas, increased minimum size limits and slot limits for the recreational fishery in the Chesapeake Bay and in the ocean, bag limit reductions in the Chesapeake Bay for the recreational fishery, and mandatory use of circle hooks when fishing with bait to reduce release mortality in the recreational striped bass fishery. I think it's safe to say that no one wants to see this stock in the shape it was during the 1980s when a coastwide moratorium was in place. So it's important that the addendum implements effective management measures to recover the stock before things get worse, which would require management measures that are much more severe than what's being proposed right now. Public hearing for this addendum will be held in Manio on September 11th at 6:30 p.m. at the Dare County Commissioners Meeting Room. There's also public hearings scheduled along the coast from Virginia to Maine. The deadline for submitting comments, written comments to ASMFC is 5 p.m. on September 27th. And then the board will consider final approval of the addendum at their October meeting in New Hampshire, and management measures will be in place starting in 2020. As most of you know, it's been about 8 years since there's been any substantial ocean striped bass landings in North Carolina. So this fishery may not be in the forefront of people's minds down here, although it definitely is attracting a lot of attention from fishermen to the north of us. The landings and fishing effort in North Carolina was highest in the early 2000s when the spawning stock biomass was much higher than it is today and fishing mortality was lower. And at that time, it was a very robust recreational fishery in the late fall and early winter along the Outer Banks. It's uncertain how much a role climate change is playing in keeping ocean striped bass from migrating to North Carolina. There's a good chance we won't see them in any appreciable amount if the stock remains overfished and overfishing keeps occurring. Next up is American Eel. The American Eel Management Board approved North Carolina's glass eel aquaculture proposal that was submitted on behalf of the American Eel Farm in Trenton, North Carolina. North Carolina's proposal had different fishing seasons and fishing times compared to the last proposal approved by ASMFC, and the request was for a two-year period. In 2019, the American Eel Farm harvested about 14 pounds of glass eels, but none of them survived due to a total mortality event in June. The board raised concerns about North Carolina's proposal allowing harvest over two calendar years, that is November through March, enforcement of the proposal's provisions, and whether the lack of production of yellow eels and total loss of glass eels by the American Eel Farm was meeting the objectives of the American Eel FMP. Due to these concerns, the board approved North Carolina's proposal for only 1 year instead of 2 years. Next up is black sea bass. The Summer Finder Scout and Black Sea Bass Management Board reviewed strategies for addressing black sea bass commercial state-by-state allocations for North Cape Hatteras. As a reminder, black sea bass south of Cape Hatteras are managed by the South Atlantic Fishery Management Council. The strategies include status quo commercial allocations, a dynamic approach that gradually shifts the allocations over time based on a combination of historical resource utilization, or known as the old quota allocations, and current stock status distribution. There's also trigger-based allocation approaches and hybrid approaches that combine these different options. North Carolina has 11% of the commercial black sea bass quota for North of Hatteras, and these state-specific allocations have been in place since 2003. Management action could be initiated when the board meets with the Mid-Atlantic Council at their meeting in October, just over in Durham, North Carolina. So I'll keep you posted on all of this as it develops. And then finally, finish up with spiny dogfish. Spiny Dogfish Management Board approved Draft Addendum 6 to the Spiny Dogfish FMP for public comment. The draft addendum proposes allowing the commercial quota to be transferred between regions and states. Right now, the coastwide commercial allocation is allocated to the states of Maine and Connecticut as a regional allocation, but the states from North Carolina to New York all have state-specific allocations. The states can transfer quota to each other, and in last fishing season, North Carolina transferred about 2 million pounds of dogfish quota to Virginia, but quota transfers can occur with the northern region. This could result in states running out of quota this year because this year's quota is 46% less than what it was last year. So the public comment period will occur in September, and the board will take final action on this at their meeting in October. And this is a pretty straightforward addendum, so a hearing won't be held in North Carolina. In fact, I think only two states are requesting hearings. But folks can weigh in by submitting written comments or participating in the public hearing webinar. And that concludes my ASMFC report, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you, Chris. And Chris does a great job at ASMFC, as does Commissioner Blanton, who somehow has time to work crab pots from time to time. Now for an update on the South Atlantic Fishery Management Council. I'd like to bring Steve.
Well, he's got Mid-Atlantic.
Oh, you got the Mid-Atlantic. Sorry about that. Yeah. That's not on my sheet.
It's on mine here.
Should have stayed quiet. Thanks. This is quicker. And this is from the Mid-Atlantic Council meeting that took place in June in the quaint little village of Midtown Manhattan. I'll just cover one probably main highlight of interest to the commission was a discussion on the river herring and shad catch cap for the Atlantic mackerel fishery. The council decided to take no action on modifying that cap for the 2019 fishing year. This came up because the river herring and shad cap for the Atlantic mackerel fishery was reached back in mid-March, which closed the directed Atlantic mackerel fishery when only a small portion of the 2019 quota was landed. And this is a precautionary measure to prevent too many river herring and shad in the ocean to be caught incidental to the Atlantic herring or to the Atlantic mackerel fishery. There's also one for Atlantic herring in the New England Council. Just to jump forward, and I'll have more information in the brief material in November, but the Mid-Atlantic Council met last week to revisit the 2020 catch cap, and instead of having a trigger, what was in place now is it's 129 metric ton cap, so or 89 metric tons when Atlantic mackerel landings are below 10,000 metric tons. So what's happened in the last couple of years is the cap hits or surpasses 89 metric tons before the mackerel landings hit 10,000. And that's been kind of an issue that's tough to get around. So the staff recommended a higher cap with no trigger. However, the Mid-Atlantic Council recommended keeping the 129 metric ton cap, but just removing the trigger. And I think there'll probably be some additional work in the future to try to address this in a different way or more complete way, and maybe look at what they're doing with Atlantic herring, because the same boats that target Atlantic herring target mackerel, Atlantic mackerel too. And just one little final piece of information that we learned last week is the lawsuit that the state of New York filed against NOAA Fisheries on the 2019 summer flounder specifications, also better known as the quota. That was dismissed. However, the judge is allowing the state of New York to, what the term was, to refile the lawsuit by April or May, basically around the time that National Marine Fisheries Service is expected to put out a proposed rule on the quota allocations that that the council took final action on back in March. So that concludes my Mid-Atlantic Council report.
Questions? That one's shorter. I'm almost slipped by me.
That's all right.
Okay, great. Thank you, Chris. Appreciate it. Director?
Thank you, Chris. For an update on South Atlantic Council, I'd like to call Steve Poland up.
Thank you. Hello again. So, since there's some new faces, I'll introduce myself. I'm Steve Poland. I'm the Executive Assistant for Councils. I serve as Steve Murphy's proxy as the state rep on the South Atlantic Fishery Management Council for the great state of North Carolina. So the council last met in June in Stuart, Florida. We covered a lot of different topics, kind of touched on most of the fishery complexes that we manage at this last meeting. I apologize for providing a four-page memo. It was just really hard to condense everything we did down in June. Snapper grouper actions, so we decided to move forward with adjusting the ACL on blue line tilefish. This was a holdover action from a couple years ago after the last blue line tilefish assessment under the current ABC control rule. There was a little bit of extra quota that was available, but in anticipation of new recreational catch estimates coming out with the implementation of the new MRIP fishing effort survey, the council decided to hold off on making any changes to the ACL until they saw those new catch estimates. But the SSC took this issue up back in April and decided that because recreational catch estimates of blue line tilefish were highly variable, and it did not appear that apparent increases in effort in the new fishing effort survey would really contribute to increases in the catch stream for blue line tilefish, they decided to move forward and provide the council ABC recommendation. So the ABC for blue line tilefish, or the allowable biological catch for blue line tilefish, increased to 233,968 pounds. This is something that our fishermen in the Northern Outer Banks have been requesting for some time now, both commercial and recreational fishermen up there, the for-hire sector that fishes out of Oregon Inlet and Hatteras. They don't have a lot of bottom fish to target up there. It's primarily just blue line tilefish. So this is something that, they've provided comment numerous times to the council, and our Mid-Atlantic rep, Dewey Himmelwright, who is also the liaison to the South Atlantic, has brought this forward numerous times. We continued work on Regulatory Amendment 33. This amendment aims to provide more flexibility to the council for setting the red snapper season. This will remove the three-day minimum projected season and adjust the start date and time of the year for recreational red snapper. We had two public hearings in North Carolina last week with zero attendance from North Carolina stakeholders. So we did not receive any input from our anglers as far as what time of the year they would like their red snapper season to be, and if they would like weekends, weekdays, that kind of input. So we're going to discuss this in 3 weeks in Charleston, and I will have to do my legwork and reach out to some folks and get some input on this to decide where we want to go, or if we want to go down this route. Council continued discussions on Regulatory Amendment 29. This is our best fishing practices amendment, and this is the amendment that contains the circle hook requirement for the snapper grouper fishery, as well as a descending device requirement and the removal of prohibitions of power heads off South Carolina in the EEZ. There was a lot of discussion about where to draw the line for the circle hooks. East Coast of Florida has been pretty vocal in their opposition of a circle hook requirement down there for some of their headboat fisheries, or they call them drift boats. They feel like in the yellowtail snapper fishery and a few others that circle hooks would reduce their harvests to a point that those trips would not be profitable anymore. So there's a lot of discussion on the record on that, and the council decided to keep the same 28 degrees north latitude line that we've had in previous actions, just to keep the whole amendment moving forward. We'll take final action on this amendment in 3 weeks at our Charleston meeting. And currently the selected alternatives or preferred alternatives would be non-offset, non-stainless steel circle hooks are required when in possession of snapper grouper species in the EEZ of the South Atlantic north of 28 degrees north latitude. South of 28 degrees, it's still a requirement to have non-offset, non-stainless steel hooks. And also, it'll be a requirement to have a descending device on board. And there's still some debate at the council and input from law enforcement if rigged and ready language can be included and enforceable in that action. So moving on to Dolphin Wahoo Amendment 10. We spent an inordinate amount of time on Dolphin Wahoo Amendment 10. I think it's got 19 different actions, but this is the first comprehensive plan amendment since the first plan was adopted back in 2004. So have to take care of some housekeeping things, framework things. But we're main issues that'll affect anglers here in North Carolina. There's actions included in this amendment to potentially adjust the vessel limit. Currently, the vessel limit, the recreational vessel limit for dolphin is no more than 60 per vessel. We're discussing options to go as far down as 40 fish per vessel, but there's also option included to only drop the vessel limit from South Carolina and south. Other actions in the amendment include the potential for bag limit sales from the for-hire sector. There was a lot of discussion on this at the committee level and at the full council level, and we decided to remove that action from consideration. But since this is, since we were not taking final action, that's still out there on the table and might be discussed again before we wrap this plan up. The council also decided to move forward with including bullet mackerel and frigate mackerel as forage fish and ecosystem component species in the Dolphin Wahoo plan. We had a lot of discussion around how to include ecosystem component species and acknowledge that forage fish component of those two species, and we decided to move forward with a plan amendment and focus on creating a framework within the Dolphin Wahoo plan that would allow us to add species in the future if the council so chose. Miscellaneous action, the council directed staff to initiate amendment to adjust commercial trip limit for spiny lobster north of Florida. And this was a request that Tim Griner, who is our one of our council representatives here in North Carolina, he brought to the council. He's spoken to this a few times on the record, but felt compelled at this meeting to make this request. So this would, or there's options in this request that would increase the spiny lobster trip limit for commercial operations up to as much as, I think, 100 tails, but the options range from 20 to 100 tails. And we have not discussed this in a full decision document yet. I think this is coming back to the council in Charleston in 3 weeks, and this is something that snapper grouper fishermen with tailing permits and SG1 permits have requested for some time, not only here in North Carolina, but also in South Carolina. And we've received input from a lot of spear fishermen that would like to see this as well. And it's a way to make these snapper grouper trips just a little bit more profitable. The way these trips operate, they'll go out for multiple days. And at two per person, especially if they catch those spiny lobster earlier in the trip, there's a lot of times where these spiny lobsters will spoil before they get back to the dock. But, you know, also it's not worth the time to keep two spiny lobster. So they would like a little bit more than that. All right. So moving on, we spent a little bit of time during the mackerel cobia committee talking about Spanish mackerel. Spanish mackerel in the northern and the southern zone. The council just completed our allocation reviews trigger, and this was something that was mandated by the Modernizing Fish Act. Basically, we had to provide National Marine Fisheries Service a plan to review sector allocations for all our species with either social or quantifiable or time-related triggers in that. We prioritize Spanish mackerel and king mackerel very early on in that table. We'll take the issue up, I think, in 2021 after completion of the Spanish mackerel stock assessment, unless the council feels compelled to review that issue earlier. Fishermen from the southern zone or in Florida, or from South Carolina down to Florida, and representatives from the northern zone from the states both provided input to the council that then we need to take a little bit of time and look at this issue with the commercial Spanish mackerel fishery. Later in the report, when I get to commercial closures in the South Atlantic, I'll talk a little bit more about the Spanish mackerel commercial closure, but that fishery will close tomorrow at the end of the day. That's about 7 weeks earlier than it typically closes here in the northern zone. And it's really before the peak of fall landings for Spanish mackerel. So there's some concerns of increased discards in that fishery when the king mackerel net fishery interacts with Spanish mackerel, and also just a lot of concerns raised from fishermen as far as, you know, I don't have anything to target this time of the year. So the council is aware of these issues and does plan to work on these. We do have a mackerel committee meeting coming up in September where we'll discuss this further and develop some options. And lastly, from the human side, Executive Director Greg Wall announced his retirement from the council. He served the council for 39 years. He came to the council right after grad school and started, I think, in the mackerel and spiny lobster plan, and has moved his way up to executive director, and he served as the executive director of the council for the last 4 years. And the December meeting in Wilmington will be his last meeting, so please come and bid him adieu. All right, the next meeting will be in Charleston the week of September 16th through 20th. And I just noticed a typo in my memo. That's Charleston, South Carolina, not Charleston, Florida. My apologies. And lastly, it just provides you an update of commercial and recreational closures in the South Atlantic since the last time we met. On the commercial side, blue line tilefish, golden tilefish, the other Jack's complex, so the Jack's complex that does not include greater amberjack, snowy grouper, and as I mentioned earlier, Spanish mackerel will close this Friday. Director Steve Murphy did send a quota transfer request to Jessica McCauley with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission requesting 100,000 pounds of southern zone quota be transferred to the northern zone. She notified us earlier this week that they were denying that request on the grounds that they were also anticipating a early closure in the southern zone. So our fishery closing the end of this week is about 7 weeks early. They're anticipating about a 10-week early closure in the southern zone. So she regretfully declined to transfer 100,000 pounds of Spanish mackerel quota to the northern zone. And on the recreational side, golden tilefish closed back in June. We had our two-week red snapper season back in July. It was 5 days this year. And the deep water complex, as well as blue line tilefish and snowy grouper, seasonal closure starts in the end of August. And that's a 8-month closure that goes from the end of August to the end of April. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Any questions? Thank you.
All right.
Mr. Director.
Yeah, thank you, Steve. And I think Steve and Randy Gregory did an awful lot of outreach in the last month or so trying to see if we could get a little more time on that Spanish mackerel fishery, because we were, you know, we knew we were getting close to that quota. So, and it's a pretty healthy stock right now. So I'd like to recognize Randy Gregory, so to give us an update on highly migratory species.
Good afternoon. My name is Randy Gregory. I represent the state of North Carolina on the Highly Migratory Species Advisory Panel. We have an upcoming meeting in 2 weeks in Silver Spring, Maryland. There's really three issues right now that are of concern to us as far as HMS species go. We just had a scoping meetings for Amendment 13. Amendment 13 looks at refining the individual bluefin tuna quota program for the pelagic longline. It's looking at reassessing the allocation of bluefin tuna quotas, which include discontinuing or phasing out the purse seine fishery. There are five permits in the purse seine fishery for bluefin tuna. There are no vessels. The fishery hasn't operated in several years, yet we still give 18% of the baseline quota to that fishery. We are hopefully going to eliminate that fishery altogether and distribute the bluefin tuna quota proportionally to the rest of the categories with some luck, and I think we'll be able to do that. We're also going to be able to look at possibly some the changes in the quotas and maybe adding something, maybe adding a month or two to the general category that might affect our winter bluefin fishery that happens down here that's a commercial general category fishery. There is a proposed rule to adjust some measures to manage bluefin bycatch in the pelagic longline fishery off of Cape Hatteras. It's called the Cape Hatteras gear restricted area. Basically, it goes from the offshore of Cape Hatteras up through the point along the break, and it was a area where you had to get conditional permission to go in there in longline just to prevent the interactions with bluefin tunas. The individual bluefin tuna quota with the pelagic longline has made that area useless at this point in time. Those guys only have a small amount of quota they can catch. So if they catch their 20 fish or 15 fish or whatever it is that they have to quit, they won't be able to longline anymore. So they don't want to get any big catches of bluefin tuna, because if they catch them, they have to bring them on board, and at that point in time they would quit fishing. So this regulation will be hopefully eliminated, and we won't have to worry with that restricted area. The third issue is scoping for Amendment 14 for shark fishery, and then that's a process of re-examining how to establish annual catch limits and accounting for uncertainty and stock assessments with the shark fisheries. So it's just a way of how they would handle the unassessed stocks, as well as establishing catch limits for some species that are hard to manage that way. So anyway, that's all I have for you. If I have any questions, I'll be glad to answer those.
Questions? Right. Thank you, Randy.
All right, thank you. Have a good afternoon.
You too. Mr. Director.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thanks to all three of those guys. They do a great job. So finally, I'd refer you to the informational materials in your notebook. We won't talk about them, but you can see them here. I know this report takes probably more time than people want it to, but I'm mighty proud of this division and the staff that they have, and they do an awful lot in between these meetings. And so I feel it's important to highlight a lot of that so that you guys can have a better appreciation of sort of what the division is and what it isn't. So I appreciate it, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Director.